Coming up on this episode of DL Weekly, Disneyland is turning 67, what the resort is doing to celebrate, zombies are coming to downtown Disney.
The app is making it easier to find your car, Christmas in July. We talked to Fletch about a new Disney board game and more. DL Weekly starts now.
Hello, everyone. Welcome aboard the DL Weekly podcast. Please lower your head and watch your step while boarding. If this is your first time listening, we hope you'll check out our website at dlweekly.net. If you have more time to spend, becoming an official weekly tier at doweekly.net/support is an especially good value. Thanks for traveling with us today, and we hope you have a happy and memorable listen to this week's episode.
Hello and welcome to this episode of DL Weekly for the week of July 13th, 2022. I'm Teg Bushman.
And I'm Teresa Urban. We would like to thank all of our current weekly tiers for supporting your show. Without your support, DL Weekly would not be possible. Your support ensures that the podcast will continue and that we can make it to the parks more often to bring you the latest news and information right from the parks. If you would like to become an official weekly tier, head on over to dlweekly.net/support to sign up.
Well, our friends over at All Enchanting Ears have been busy, of course. They make fun and unique ears, ear holders, straw toppers, lithophanes, and more. One of their newest things that they have now are these 3D ears, which are pretty amazing. If any of you have watched any of our streams recently, we had one where they had sent us some, and they're pretty cool. They have some magnets on them, and you can easily swap them out and everything like that. And they are running a sale right now. So if you buy one set of 3D ears, you get your second set at 67% off by using the promo code 3D67OFF through July 17th. So, of course, that's for Disneyland's birthday.
Mm-hmm.
So with that special discount code, you just go to allenchantingears.com and use that at checkout. And then if you are listening to this after July 17th, you can always use the DL Weekly 10 promo code to get 10% off your entire purchase.
We have some more details to share, and we want to share in our excitement for the upcoming D23 meetup. We will have a weekly tier meetup at the Disneyland Hotel near the fireplace over by Trader Sam's on Saturday, September 10th from 8 to 10 p.m. If you can stop by for any amount of time, please feel free. We will also be at the Expo the entire weekend, so if you see us around, please stop us and say hi.
Now let's get to the news.
Disneyland's anniversary month, and that means we need to celebrate. And what better way than to try some celebration foods at the resort? Some of the bites include a Mickey-shaped chocolate donut, a birthday cookie box, Walt's chili cheese fries, and so much more. There's also a fun birthday ear bowl that you can order with either some ice cream or some peaches and cream funnel cake fries. This month also celebrates Oga's birthday, back in Galaxy's Edge with some birthday drinks, a new sushi roll, and other fun food options. Offerings.
Yeah, so of course Disney doing it again with all the great sweets and treats and everything. I do have to say that this cupcake looks amazing. It's the Disneyland birthday cupcake, which is a vanilla cake with sprinkles and frosting, but it's got like a little castle on it. Mm-hmm. It looks like some little bunting on it. It looks really good. I would totally eat that.
What's interesting to me is it looks, according to the Disney Parks article, the cupcake is actually available at the Disney's Grand Californian Hotel. I would have thought that this was going to be at Jolly Holiday because that's where you typically get the birthday cupcake treats, but this fancy cupcake's over at Grand Californian.
Well, and the other thing too is it says that these things are available now through July 17th.
Yes.
I would have expected usually things start on the birthday and then go afterwards.
We're
kind of doing beforehand.
We're leading up to the birthday celebration.
Does anything else look good here to you?
You know, the fries actually look good. I know that's a little weird, but they have over at the Red Rose Tavern, Walt's chili cheese fries will be available, and their seasoned fries topped, of course, with Walt's signature chili, cheddar cheese, and a little bit of green onion. It looks like comfort food and just a fun, different way to enjoy Walt's chili.
Yeah, and looking at some of these things for Oga's birthday kind of coming up as well, some of these things look like variations of what we've had before. There's some different gear puffs. There's a blue milk chia pudding that looks kind of interesting, although I'm not a huge fan of the blue milk.
See, now I feel like these things are all different and unique, especially the roll.
This looks
totally up your alley, but even just the look of it looks otherworldly. They do such an amazing job, I think, with the visual on these different dishes mm-hmm. that are coming to us from a galaxy far, far away. But like the blue milk chia pudding, that does, I don't feel like we've had anything like that before. And the wheat gear puffs look amazing. Now, these are a little snack that I've had before, not with the seasoning stuff sure. on. And I'm like super excited about this. We will, of course, won't be able to get out there ourselves to right. try these delicious offerings. But if you make it out there and if you're able to try these, let us know what you think.
I wish Disney would have more sushi-inspired stuff because I would love to have more sushi available in the park.
I just feel like with the volume of food that they pump out, sushi would be very difficult. Unless they do a sushi restaurant or like one specific place. Because I'm just thinking, remember last time we were at Docking Bay and the just gallons and gallons and gallons of the
cold brew
they were prepping for all of the mobile orders? I'm thinking, okay, coffee, a little bit easier to do in bulk sushi. Like that, but sushi in that kind of bulk and demand, whew. But I'm really hoping, Disney, if you're listening, Harryhausen's, we need a Harryhausen's themed restaurant in the new Pixar themed hotel. I think that would be good. So amazing.
That would be good. Well, some undead folks are coming to the Disneyland Resort. Zombeats Bash is a 20-minute interactive stage show where you'll dance and sing along with music from the Disney Channel film Zombies and Zombies 2. This is all ahead, of course, of the release of Zombies 3 on Disney Plus July 15th and later to the Disney Channel. You could find Life Again at the Downtown Disney Live stage at 2, 3, and 4 in the afternoon, July 29th through the 31st.
This, you know, this is not a movie or a franchise that I'm very familiar with, but the visuals are always very fun because yes, these characters are zombies, but they don't look, they're not your scary, gross, creepy looking zombies. Like their makeup is more lively, I will say, than other zombies I've seen. So maybe I need to take some time and check out a zombie movie.
Have you seen like a trailer or something for this? Is that where you got that visuals?
Well, it's first, there's some visuals in the article, but yeah, I don't know if I've seen trailers or what I've seen.
This.
Oh, yeah, see? No, I've seen... Maybe I've just been seeing promos for the new Zombie 3 movie. That's what it is.
Oh, that could be it. Do you think that this would be a good show? Not a good show, but like a show along the lines of like Descendants or
yes.
something like that? Okay, because
yes.
I like the Descendants movies. Maybe I yes. should give this one a try.
That same genre type of, you know, same type of genre film. Type.
Gotcha.
So show of hands, who here has gone to Disneyland and perhaps at the end of their very, very fun evening, don't quite remember where exactly it was that they left their car for the night? That would be me if I drove. Well, fear not. An update to the Disneyland app will add a Where's My Car features. Guests can use location technology on their phones to enter their car location and pull it up again at the end of the night. It works best with phone features like Bluetooth, location services, and notifications. There isn't a confirmed rollout date for Disneyland other than this year. We will get to see how it works over in Disney World sometime this summer.
Now, the first thing I said to producer James when we were kind of talking a little bit about this earlier was, if you use like Google Maps, it already like puts a little mark like where you left
yeah.
your car. So I feel like this is just, I mean, I guess it's convenient if you didn't get there with maps. You and I don't use this because we don't drive
there. I'm just thinking about any time you go park somewhere. So like,
yeah.
say we're parking at the airport or we're parking at some place very giant around here, like the Mall of America. We
sure.
either have to take a picture of like the post and the section that we're on, or we have to like write ourselves a little note or send each other a text, something like we have to give ourselves a reminder because you can get very lost there. And I'm sure Disneyland parking structures are,
you know, what's funny, you talk about taking pictures, I did that when we
yeah.
were picking my brother up from the airport, and you know what happens, I never look back at the photo, I just try to figure it out because I forget by the time that I had taken a photo. I'm like, oh, I'll take a photo so I remember, and then I don't remember.
Yeah, well, at least you've got the photo if needed.
That's true. Well, guests looking to prove they're worthy can try their hand at picking up Mjolnir alongside the mighty Thor in Avengers Campus. Jane Foster's version of the hero is making appearances in the park near the ancient sanctum. Grab a photo and grab the handle of the mythical hammer to see if they're mighty enough to wield it too. This is neat.
Okay, so not only is it cool enough that we have a brand new superhero in Avengers Campus, but the fact that they are using some magical magnetic technology to make it that to it's kind of like the sword, like how we used to have
that's
the sword in the
say,
stone
yeah.
where, you know, they can magic spoiler They can choose which guests are worthy and are able to pick up the hammer, and then other guests can try with all of their might and not be able to move it. I think that is so awesome.
They need to bring back the Sword and the Stone show.
We want Merlin.
Teresa's banging on stuff. I like this idea. I thought it was kind of cool that they have some type of technology that they're using here to make it so it's more, not impossible, but more difficult to pick up from somebody. So that could be kind of cool. And for little kids especially, that's because you can imagine they're like pulling on it and then it can pick up or something like that. I don't know. It'd be so cool.
Nobody's reported 100% on how it works, but one of the reports that I read, which I believe is in the Mice Chat article that we've got linked, is magnets. And so they'd be able to, I don't know how that would work, because it, right,
you could
sword,
have an electromagnet, they could have like a button that turns it on and off.
There
yeah.
you go. I was going to say, how do you turn a magnet on and off? But there you go. You already answered my question before I even asked. Good job.
Now, did you and Vern get a chance to see Thor yet? The new Thor
movie?
Oh,
no. We have not.
It's pretty decent. It's pretty funny. It's definitely like the most lighthearted, I think, of all of the Thors, and the other Thors were pretty lighthearted. Hmm. But there's a couple, for people who have seen it, there's...
Now don't go spoiling it for the rest of us.
For people who have seen it already, there's a pair of animals that are quite entertaining in that movie,
okay.
for sure.
Okay.
Not in some dirty way. It's a Disney movie.
I'm just like, this is the weirdest little, like, if you know, you know.
Oh, yeah. No,
entertaining
it's
animals.
It's cool. And the fact that it brings Natalie Portman back, which mm-hmm. brings up another story that they had this week that Taika Waititi asked if she wanted to be in a Star Wars movie. And it's like, Padme Amidala?
Yeah, excuse me?
That's all right. He's pretending that didn't exist, I guess.
Well, just a quick update on the refurbishment schedule. Haunted Mansion will go down on August 15th until it reopens again September 1st, rematerializing as the Haunted Mansion holiday. That same day, Monsters, Inc. over in DCA will also be going down for some TLC. There is no known date for its reopening or if there are any changes beyond regular maintenance. My guess is regular maintenance, though.
Yeah. Yeah, we one of our weekly tiers actually works in that attraction, and they seem like they're pretty excited to go through that. I will say when we were there, it seemed like it was having a lot of times where it would go down for a period of time. I don't know if that's a maintenance issue or not, but it'll be nice to get some TLC in there. I never noticed anything like not working or anything in there. It seemed like it was doing pretty good, but
so
maybe some of the smells weren't as vivid as they once were.
Yeah, that could be. The other thing, too, I wonder is since we've seen a lot of updates in... projection technology for other things, if some of the areas that Randall, when Boo is on Randall and she's bopping him over the head and he's changing different colors, things like that, like maybe they'll update the projection technology for little elements. I think there'll be
I didn't even think of that.
Minor plussing, but just an overall refresh to give the monsters a little TLC and some R&R.
Well, Hallmark is hoping you want to celebrate Christmas in July. I have a friend who loves Christmas in July.
Boy, do we, after seeing these ornaments.
The 2022 collection of ornaments feature Dumbo, Pirates, Haunted Mansion, and the 50th anniversary of Walt Disney World. Prices of the ornaments range from $20 to $48, and I agree with you. There's a couple cool ones.
So just a note, the Haunted Mansion ornament is actually one that they had before that is... I get to use this word twice in one podcast, rematerializing again this year. But the Pirates, I think, of the collection, I'm not going to count Haunted Mansion since it's not brand new this year. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, clearly, the Hitchhiking Ghost would be my favorite. But the Pirates statue, I just love it. It's the Pirates ornament. I just love it. It's of the pirate hanging out with the pigs in the pigsty, and... he looks like he's sleeping in the attraction. He doesn't quite look like he's sleeping as hard or as deeply in this ornament, but it was just so fun. It's so cute.
Yeah.
And of course, with Pirates celebrating its anniversary this year, perfect choice.
I will say one of my favorites is this. I know it's Disney World, but I do like this ornament of it's got Cinderella Castle on it. And I just think it's really kind of, I love the design. It's very beautiful. I was kind of excited by that one. It lights up all
cool.
It does.
It lights up.
The Haunted Mansion one, though, I feel like is a must-have. I feel like I'm going to have to buy this.
They've had this one. So this one, they've had it previous years. So it lights up, and I want to say it also plays Grim Grinning Ghosts. So it's a double whammy.
Oh. See, I don't need it to play. I just need it to light up. That's pretty cool.
And I didn't mention that the Pirates of the Caribbean one plays Yo-Ho, Yo-Ho.
Oh. And then there's like a Dumbo one, which poor Dumbo gets put away, put up with all these other cool ones. And it's just poor Dumbo.
It's cute though. It's still cute. But the ornaments are very cool. I think, as a lot of you already know, Hallmark does a really nice job, especially I believe with their Disney ornaments. So it's always fun and exciting to see what park-inspired ornaments they're coming out with next. A new docuseries will take us behind the scenes of films from a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. Light and Magic is a 6-part series that will talk about the origins and evolutions of Industrial Light and Magic, the visual effects company that helped bring us Star Wars, Indiana Jones, and so much more. It's directed by Lawrence Kasdan, an Oscar-nominated writer who worked across the Star Wars trilogies and so much more. It starts streaming on Disney Plus July 27th.
Oh, that's not even too long from now.
It's not.
So this is along the lines, I feel like, it's kind behind of, for attraction. Me, it's a, yeah, it's like a behind the attraction meets Imagineering story meets kind of the Disney gallery stuff for the different TV shows, because it's going to have like a whole bunch
and
of stuff.
Almost a little bit of prop culture in there too.
Oh, that's true. So I'm very excited. So my brother's visiting from Turkey right now, and he loves documentaries. Mm-hmm. So we've been slowly going through the Imagineering story, which he's really enjoyed. And I showed him the trailer for this, and he's like, this thing's going to be awesome.
Yeah.
Also, he's very happy because Disney Plus actually just came to Turkey, so he can get it and watch all of these things. He's very excited about it. I love these types of things, and I'm so glad Disney Plus is around, because I feel like if it were not for Disney Plus, we would not get things like this.
Yeah, nope. 100%.
We need some more behind the attraction, too. Are you excited about this show?
I am excited about this show. I was talking, we were talking about it in the chat, and it's, you know, it's just something that I've never really thought about. Like, you know, how do they do all these things? And I'm naive and don't really understand what's real, what's not real, what's a miniature, what's not a miniature. So I think it'd be really, really interesting to kind of peel back all the layers to see how some of these things that we've, some of these scenes that, I mean, we've grown up with, how they came to be. I think that'll be really cool. The trailer is amazing. So if you haven't watched it yet, I highly recommend that you take the time to watch the trailer. Just watching the trailer, it gave me a lot of like WED vibes, because it was a lot of, we don't really know how we're going to do this, but we're going to make it happen. And they just kind of just hardworking, brilliant bunch of people that just created a lot of somethings out of nothing, really. And they were doing things that just didn't even exist, which is just really incredible to think about, and to think about how that technology has evolved so much over the past decades and years. Mm-hmm. It's just, yeah, it's really, really incredible. So I'm very excited. I'm also excited that it's, what, a six part series?
Oh, even
so I feel
better.
Like we're going to get a lot of information about it, too.
You know, I think it was Walt Disney that said it's kind of fun to create the impossible. So this is totally, totally that.
DO Weekly announces the boarding of the Trivia Express, nonstop star speeder service to the moon of Endor. All passengers, please prepare for immediate boarding.
Welcome to Trivia Land. How are we feeling tonight? Are you ready for some good ones?
You know, I always feel pretty all right until...
He starts talking.
Yeah. Until... It's not always the first question, but one of the questions every week, I'm like, ooh.
Well, Vern, I'm gonna go against what I normally say. I'm feeling pretty good tonight.
All right. Well, we've got some great listener-submitted questions, and we've got one question from when I fell down a rabbit hole, or a Pooh Bear hole, as it is. And let's see how you do.
All right.
All right. So your first question, submitted by listener Keith N. When the Jungle Cruise first opened, what was on display in front of the entrance?
What was on display?
What?
Like
specifically an animal that was displayed.
An animal, though. This is a little nugget of trivia. This isn't even tickling anything in my brain. Like, I've heard of this before.
The only thing I'm thinking about,
I'm gonna be honest with you, this was a hard one to vet, but I was able to vet this.
Can we have a hint? Is it a full animal, or just like you could only see part of an animal?
Full animal.
See, the only thing that I can think of that stands out to me, and it's probably not right, is that jade elephant that they have up on the roof now. It'd be really cool to have that
jade elephant.
Sure, jade elephant. So, I mean, what else am I going to say? What was on display in front of the Jungle Cruise?
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of what animals. That's hard. They're so, like, most of the animals are very large.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't funny.
Could have been serious. A monkey.
I'm going to say a... yeah, it could have been a monkey. For some reason, I was thinking a snake.
A snake?
Yeah.
A snake?
Is that what you're going with?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because, like, first I was thinking, like, a hippo, but I don't know how you'd get that.
That's a little large,
That's a little large. And the elephants are the other, like, things that come to mind.
Yeah.
Or the giraffes, but I...
So a jade elephant and a snake. Final answers?
I think so.
Yeah, they're not very good, but there they are.
All right, then. Your second question, submitted by listener Donna S. What two attractions in Fantasyland have a mermaid?
Specifically in Fantasyland.
Well, that would be the Storybook Land canal boats, because you see Ariel in towards the end, because you can look down in the thing, right?
You don't see her, though. They call it Ariel's Grotto.
Yeah.
Where they put the boats, and then they also have
But where
like,
else would you
castle.
See Ariel?
The mermaids. Oh, so mermaids. Peter Pan's Flight.
Oh, yes, yes. Peter Pan's Flight. Yes.
In Fantasyland.
Are there any mermaids, like, on the carousel or anything like that? Like, painted on the carousel? There's no mermaids in the village house, or what used to be.
We're gonna
cheat a little bit.
We're gonna call upon
the chat,
and we're gonna use a lifeline, Elijah, in our chat. Because just sidebar, if you're wondering what we're talking about with the chat and why we're kind of referring to people as we're, you know, if we refer to people as we're chatting with the news and the trivia and stuff, one of the perks of being an official weekly tier at the AP and above levels is that we have a monthly live stream of our episode recording, and tonight happens to be that night. So we've got a bunch of weekly tiers watching us record this live on YouTube, and we've got a chat here, and so a lot of weekly tiers. We usually try to minimize the chat so we're not cheating, but we forgot to. So we're using a lifeline, and we're going to use Elijah's reminder that Small World is the second one. Good.
Peter Pan, Small World.
Silly me, I forget that Small World
me
is still
too.
Fantasyland because it's so far back.
Me too. I always forget about It's a Small World for Fantasyland because it seems so removed.
Worse is that Ariel. Like, Ariel's one of those, and we're like, oh, no, we can't see. We were even talking about Ariel, and we forgot where she actually is in Fantasyland. So,
there
Peter Pan's
go.
Flight and Small World are our final answers.
Boom.
Okay.
We've minimized the chat now. Just
All right. No more lifelines.
You don't want to phone a friend? No, I guess I would have been phone a friend.
Well, phoning
so
a friend.
Use
oh, yeah.
50-50
or the
for
audience.
Your next one?
The audience.
This isn't Who Wants to Be a Millionaire.
Okay. All right. Your third regular round question, submitted by me as I fell down a rabbit hole because I was vetting another question. What percentage of the way through The Many Adventures of Winnie the Pooh are you when you see the psychedelic Tigger?
What percentage of the way through?
I'm going to say 50, because I...
Where is the psychedelic
Tigger? In the Heffalumps and Woozles.
Oh, you're probably 70% of the
you
way through.
You think 70?
Yeah, because it's Heffalumps and Woozles is like later. Because basically you exit Heffalumps and Woozles, it's like birthday party and you're done.
But now I don't remember what part of the room he's in, because it's a very large room.
I don't know, 70%.
70% and 50%? Are those your final answers?
Those are the random guesses, yes.
Are they final answers or are they random guesses?
Well, both.
Alrighty then.
Maybe it's like 80%. I don't know.
And your fourth and final regular round question, submitted by listener Jill M. How many different spellings for honey are there in the Winnie the Pooh? In The Many Adventures of Winnie the Pooh.
So there's H-U-N-N-Y, H-O-N-E-Y.
So now, but if they flip around letters, like, because the N's are
sometimes... Oh, does that count?
Yeah, does that count as a separate
around?
Flip?
I'm asking for a number.
Yeah, but I'm saying if the N is flipped, does that count as a different...
Oh, no.
Okay.
Dyslexia doesn't count.
So there's the regular spelling, there's the H-U-N-N-Y.
Do they spell it correctly? I don't know if it's ever spelled correctly.
Well, I don't know. I'm going to put that in there. I'm going to say 4. It's probably more. It's 7.
I'm going to say 3.
4. I'm going to say 4. 4 final answer for me.
And three final answer for me, because I can only think of three off the top of my head.
So that's four and three?
Yep.
All right. And your bonus question, related to the last question.
Oh, boy.
Can you spell the different spellings?
H-U-N-N-Y.
H-U-N-N-Y, yep.
H-O-N-E-Y.
And then I feel like there's just an H-U-N-Y.
Y. H-U-N-Y, okay. And then that's your three, so I'm trying to think of like a four.
H-O-N-Y?
Honey. That's like honey. Maybe it's like H-O-I-E. Yeah, let's put an I-E on there. H-U-N-I-E. Sure. We're terrible. Maybe I should have stuck with your three. Final answers, Vern.
Okay, so I got H-U-N-N-Y, regular spelling of H-O-N-E-Y, H-U-N-Y, and H-U-N-I-E.
Yeah.
Unless it's H-U-N-E-Y.
Final answers.
Oh.
I'm switching mine to H-U-N-E-Y.
That's a good one.
Are you switching yours to that?
Yeah,
too?
So switch. Yeah, switch my H-U-N-I-E to H-U-N-E-Y.
Oh, so are you doing H-U-N-E-Y?
Yeah.
You're gonna keep H-U-N and
I'll keep H-U-N-Y as well. Poor Vern's over there, okay. Probably going, what?
I got them all.
Okay.
All right.
Final
answers.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, listeners, how do you think they did? How did you do listening at home? Stick around until after the discussion topic and we can all find out together.
Well, this week for our discussion topic, we are talking about board games. Now, we haven't really talked about board games before other than the fact that we've had a couple news stories about board games coming out. But we actually have... Fletch is a senior game designer for The Op, and the game we're going to talk about today mostly is the Disney Sorcerer's Arena Epic Alliance Core Pack. There's also a couple expansion packs. But we're going to start with the basic game because Teresa and I actually played it this week.
Well, and it just released... Not that long ago, too, so it's brand new to the market as well. So welcome, Fletch. We're very excited to have you on.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Doing awesome. I do have to share a little backstory.
Yes.
Some of you might be wondering, well, how the heck did you make this connection? It just so happens that a really good friend of Vern and I's was a playtester for this game. I believe Tom playtested it for over a year, so he was involved in the process. He gifted us the game as one of our wedding gifts, and so that's how we made this wonderful connection. So this is even more special to me since we have a connection through Tom, and now we get to meet you, one of the masterminds behind building this very fun game.
Yeah, working with Tom's been a lot of fun. He's it's been great meeting all of our playtesters.
Mm-hmm.
In this process, and I've been working with Tom for, like you said, about a year now, and it's just been an absolute joy to get to know him, get his input, and just play games with him.
Well, we're going to start where we always do, and we're going to find out what your Disney backstory is, because we're going to obviously get into some game stuff, but the first question we ask everybody is, tell us your Disney story. So what got you interested in Disney or the parks?
Short answer is my wife. Prior to that, I had been to Walt Disney World, I think, twice as a kid, and it was fun, but it didn't sort of become ingrained in who I was until I met my wife, and she had grown up going to Walt Disney World with her family many, many, many times as a kid. So when we got married and planned our honeymoon, she said, "We're going to Walt Disney World." And I realize you guys are all about Disneyland. I apologize. These are Disney World stories. I grew up on the East Coast.
That's okay.
But she said, "We're going to Disney World." I said, okay, I'm along for this. And we went, and I had so much fun. I don't know that I'd ever had as much fun in 1 week as I did exploring Walt Disney World and Epcot and Animal Kingdom and Hollywood Studios with my wife. And that was... Boy, that was 2004, so 18 years ago. A few years after we got married, we wound up moving to Seattle. We kept going to Disney World, despite the fact that we were on the West Coast. And people would look at us like, "What is wrong with you? Have you not been to Disneyland yet? You got to go check that out." We spent probably 12 or 13 years in Seattle before we moved down to the San Diego area. And one of the concessions I made when I said, you know, to my wife, I think we need to move to San Diego. She said, if we move to San Diego, we're becoming annual pass holders at Disneyland. And I said, yeah, I can deal with that. Let's do that. So we became annual pass holders in 2018, probably have done 30 or 40 trips to the parks up in Anaheim. We had to take that 2-year gap off where the parks were closed
for
the pandemic. But yeah, still probably 30 or 40 trips to the California Adventure and Disneyland parks since we've moved down here.
That's awesome. I love how it just kind of like snuck up on you as an adult that you just kind of got like sucked into the magic. And you know, it's one of those things that, yes, it's super magical for children, but it's also just so magical and amazing, I think, for adults. And so,
yeah,
I feel like a lot of people, some didn't get into it until later in life, and it hits you hard sometimes, and that's okay.
You know, usually we talk to the spouses who get the rest of their family into it. So it's good to hear from someone who was on the other side of it, kind of.
Yeah, I was the late adopter in this case. And it's funny because, like I said, I'd only been to Disney World twice as a kid. It was not a big piece of my family's, you know, cultural history. But when we went back to Disney World this past April, we invited Heather's parents and my own parents to stay at the parks with us for a few days just to overlap. So we had days by ourselves, we had days with family, and we got to really show my parents around the parks. My wife's family had been, again, like I said, dozens of times. My parents hadn't been there in close to 20 years.
Oh, wow.
So they were seeing things almost brand new with people that knew their way around and could point out the details that they might have otherwise missed. I got my parents to ride on Expedition Everest. And they're almost 70. And they looked at me and they said, well, do you think we could handle it? I said, I don't know. I'm not going to force you to. And my dad said, I'm doing it. I'm doing it. I'll go. And my mom looked and said, really? Well, I don't want to be the one sitting out here holding all the bags. I'll go too, I guess. So, it was really exciting.
Did they like it?
They both said one and done.
They experienced it.
My dad, years and years and years ago, loved roller coasters. And I think that this was kind of his last hurrah. No, not a bad last hurrah at all. And my mother had done, before the pandemic, I would time myself when I went into Disneyland. My wife would take our son and go one way, and I would set my watch as I went through the front gates, and I would see how fast I could ride on all four of the mountains.
Oh.
And I got it that the first time I tried it was about an hour and 7 minutes. The fastest time I ever got was about 52 minutes and 13 seconds.
Wow.
But when my parents came out to visit us in Southern California, I had taken my mother on that four mountain trek, and we didn't speed run it, but she rode all four of the mountains. And that was a really big thing for her because she's not a thrill ride person. So when we went to Expedition Everest or Animal Kingdom and we're standing outside of Expedition Everest, I think part of what was motivating my mother was that she'd done the four roller coasters at Disneyland. How different could this be? Everest is pretty different from, I enjoy all the roller coasters at Disneyland, but the roller coasters at Disneyland don't drop backwards.
Right. Yeah.
Yep. In the dark. Yeah. And you're like, where am I? I don't even understand where in this tangled mess of a track
it's just this darkened backwards centrifuge you're riding through as it goes around it loops.
Yep. It's so cool because you just lose. It's so not intense. I don't know. That's not quite. I mean, it is intense.
It's disorienting.
Yeah, exactly. It's disorienting. You're just like,
yeah, when you're going backwards, you can't see where you're going. Yeah.
And then the track flips.
Yeah, and you're like, I just came this way, but then no, I didn't. Okay.
It's so cool. So cool. Wonderful Disney story. So with that, when you enter Disneyland or the Magic Kingdom on your first day of a visit, which way do you like to go? Is there a way that you like to kind of attack the park? Do you like to mingle on Main Street? Go left towards Adventureland?
I like the roller coasters. And it's so funny because until Disney World, you know, 27 years old on our honeymoon, I was never a roller coaster person. And my wife got me to go on Thunder Mountain. And after an initial panic attack, I got through it. I got to the end and went, that was actually pretty good. Now let's go do Space Mountain. So when I go into the parks, the first thing I look at is, where is the massive crowd going to a thrill ride? And can I get to the front of that pack to ride on whatever the big thrill ride is before it gets too backed up and I won't be able to ride it at all that day? And I mentioned the speed runs of the mountains. So my path with speed running the Disneyland mountains used to be to go straight to Space Mountain. And if the line at Space Mountain was already backing up, there was usually either a single rider option or you could get a fast pass ticket. So I would either single rider right there or grab the fast pass ticket, because it usually put me about 45 minutes to where I could go do Matterhorn, then Thunder Mountain, then Splash Mountain, which also has a single rider line, which made it very easy. So if the line, not that the line on Splash Mountain was ever very long at, you know, 8:30 in the morning, because no one wants to get soaked at 8:30 in the morning.
Right.
I'm like, I'll do it, whatever.
Right, right. Get it over. I got to get it in.
But I could stop it at Space Mountain and either complete it or pick up the pass for later. Matterhorn, Thunder, Splash, and if necessary, go back to Space. So that's sort of my plan of attack when I go into the parks.
All right. Well, you've listed a few things, so we got to find out what's your favorite attraction. So even though we're a Disneyland podcast, this could be any attraction from any Disney park.
That is a toss-up, I think, between Guardians of the Galaxy Mission Breakout and Expedition Everest. I rode the Tower of Terror, Twilight Zone Tower, Hollywood. It's not Twilight Zone anymore, sorry. It's the Hollywood Hotel Tower of Terror now. And I got to say, I like the Guardians one better.
Did you ever get to experience Disney or the California version of the Tower of Terror, or only
I didn't. We moved down here just as the Guardians one was opening, or shortly after it opened. And again, like, it took me a long time to get into roller coasters. Mm-hmm. It took me even longer to get into that sort of elevator drop thrill ride. Fear of heights and falling is one of the worst things I've got. And I wouldn't ride the Tower of Terror in Orlando. But when we moved to Southern California and my wife said, it's Guardians of the Galaxy. And I said, oh man, that's one of my favorite movies. I kind of have to do this. Oh, what am I getting myself into? And then I wrote it and I went, that was awesome. And I think the music, the blasting music, when he plugs in the rocket, jumps on top of your elevator, and you see his shadow of him plugging in the Walkman, and the music just starts blasting. And I remember the first time I wrote it, it was Jackson 5, ABC 123. And everyone in the cart just starts dancing along with it as it starts bouncing up and down. And I was into it, like, right away. I was gripping for dear life, but I was totally into it. And I've ridden that one tons and tons. Like, if I can get in line for it twice in one trip, I'm doing it.
Nice.
I just love that you started your Disney journey with the parks being like, that roller coasters are not my thing. And now your favorite attractions are some of the most thrilling and extreme extreme ones. That's great. I love it.
That's what's great about Disney parks. There's something for everyone.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Before we get into the game itself, can you kind of describe what your role is at the op and how you help create board games and kind of the meat behind that process? We were talking before we started the interview, and I said, I've been a board game fan for years. Never had I thought about what happened before it ended up on the shelf and then into my home.
Like
the process. How does something like Disney Sorcerer Arena Epic Alliance even
come
begin?
To be? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, okay. So there's the general answer to that question, and then there's the Disney Sorcerer Arena Epic Alliance's specific answer to that question. The general answer, I guess, to the question of how does a board game happen, sometimes it starts with an idea for a mechanic, and then we figure out what the theme is going to be. But a lot of times, because the op works with a lot of licenses, we make games for Harry Potter, we make games for Disney, we make games for Marvel. I've made games for Friday the 13th and other horror properties. We get a license, an IP that comes to us, and the holder of those rights says, we'd like to make some game products. What can you make that matches this theme? And sometimes we start from scratch. Other times we've got a game platform or engine that we've built before that we can sort of re-theme into that new property. But basically it's a matter of figuring out what the experience we want people to have is. If I'm building a Disney game, I want it to be an enjoyable family experience that anyone can get into. If it's horror, I want that experience playing that game to be genuinely scary and a little bit, nerve rattling as you play the game. If it's Harry Potter, you want to get the experience of feeling like you're there at Hogwarts, or you're casting spells or exploring that world alongside the characters that you already know. So with Disney Sorcerers Arena Epic Alliances, we actually were approached by the team that makes the mobile game. And it's based on a mobile game. The team that makes the mobile game came to us and said, you've done some really cool projects with Disney properties in the past. We've got this game that we're working on. It's going to be out in a year or two, but we want to let you guys know about it early because we think it's got the roots, the skeleton of a great board game beyond just being a digital game that we're really excited about. And they told us about what the game could do that hadn't been done in other mobile games or board games yet. And that was, they had a battle system where you could combine heroes and villains from Disney and Pixar and live action and put them all together on a team and battle against another player who had a similar team built from this roster of, at the time, there were about 60 different characters you could pick from.
Wow.
And now there's, I think, 155, and they've announced even more.
Wow.
Coming up soon. So they said, what can you make if we gave you access to the art files and sort of the overall heart of what makes this game fun? What can you build? And I played the mobile game for a couple of weeks and got to know what made that game fun. And it was that combining of characters in ways that hadn't been done before. And it was battling against other players and accumulating points so that you could improve the abilities of your characters. Mm-hmm. It was unlocking and collecting new characters to add to your roster, because you didn't just get access to all 80 or 150 or however many. You had to gradually unlock things as you went. So there was this progression and growth as you played the game. So I took all those things and said, how do I make a board game that does all those things? I looked at a lot of other board games that I enjoyed playing that kind of evoked those same feelings and said, okay, if I deconstructed what from Unmatched really makes me feel like that catches that vibe and that feeling that matches the Disney Sorcerer's Arena mobile game, and what from Gloomhaven matches that. And I'm going to throw some wild games out there that, like, you're going to go, how is that even remotely close to a Disney game? I pulled from a game called Smash Up. I pulled from Magic the Gathering.
Oh, wow.
Being a game designer and game player, I've got, a history of 25 years or more of just processing what makes different kinds of games fun. And it's almost like taking a Lego kit and smashing it on the floor and then just building a dozen different things out of that Lego kit, seeing what you can make when you deconstruct the parts. So I deconstructed a bunch of other games and kind of put those parts back together in a way that embodied those feelings of battle and progress and mix and match teams. And all of these characters from the mobile game were designed to feel very much like they had the personality and heart of the characters that you knew from movies and cartoons. So figuring out how to represent those characters loyally and faithfully using game mechanics, specifically tabletop game mechanics, was a lot of fun. And it's challenging, and I'm still doing it now because, as we said, there's a core set, there's a couple of expansions out already, and I'm designing expansions to go as far as we can imagine into the future. So while there's 8 characters in the core set, 3 characters in each of the 2 expansions that have been either released or announced, I'm coming up with these sets of 3 for years to come, fingers crossed. And it's been absolutely just a thrill ride of its own.
That's amazing to hear about how the whole process kind of goes. Producer James plays mobile games, and he's played the mobile game version of this. And when he found out that there was a board game version of this, he was intrigued at how that was going to translate from this mobile game to a board game. And you kind of expressed kind of how you have to go through that whole process and everything. And I think he really enjoyed how it transitioned, because mobile games play so differently in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. Than, you know, a typical tabletop board game. And like I said, Producer James, he loves both types of games. And so this was kind of really a cool kind of up their alley. But my question, I guess, instead of just talking about stuff, is how do you know? So we had an exchange student this year who loved board games as well, but he used to like to come up with his own rules and expand upon things. When you're developing a game, how do you know where to stop? With rules or abilities. And I know that part of that is when you do expansions, that's where you can kind of expand upon the base, right? Mm-hmm. But how do you know when you play through something, or you come up with rules or come up with a process?
Or even that, a character.
Or a character abilities. That, like, okay, like, this is the locked in features of this, and that's good. That's going to be playable. It's going to be enjoyable. It's not too much, but it's also not too little. I know that's a huge question, but it's just so fascinating.
No, it's a great question. And I think it's funny that you started by saying, you know, you met somebody who likes board games, but then wants to iterate on those board games and come up with new house rules. I have a seven-year-old who does the same thing. When we put a board game on the table, we'll play for 2 or 3 rounds, and then he'll say, and now we're going to play it my way. And these are the new rules. And before we play a game with him, we have to say, are we going to play it by the real rules or by your rules? Okay, we'll play it the real way this time. But to answer the question, sorry.
No,
that's adorable.
That is adorable.
I'm just imagining him doing that to a game that you've designed, and you're like, now.
Here's the minute that people can just make up rules to games right, anyway. What right. gave him that idea?
Right, right.
He thinks it's a very normal thing that his dad makes board games.
Sure, yeah.
Because everyone's dad does stuff like that, right?
Yeah, yeah. That's so cool.
it is not lost on me. So designing games in a lot of ways is a mix of art and science. And I literally have a background in art. I went to school for graphic design. So I probably approach it more from the aesthetic sort of feel direction than just the math and mechanics side. I'm able to do both, but when I'm trying to figure out where the game is done, a lot of that is by feel. It's funny because I used to give, when I was working in another studio up in Seattle, there were graphic designers who'd start down the path of creating a board game, and they would say, well, where do you start? And I would say, you know, honestly, sometimes I just start at the end and then figure out, like, what is my end experience? What do I want the players to do and feel? And what do I have to give them to make them experience that moment? And then I work backwards towards the start to say, if a board game starts in sort of this zero-point neutral state, am I starting with cards in hand? Am I starting with pieces on a board? What does my first turn look like that pushes me towards that end experience that I want the players to have? So for Disney Sorcerer's Arena Epic Alliances, I wanted the players to have a battle where somebody would come out the victor and score more points than the other player. And they would have done this by moving characters around the board that felt like the Disney and Pixar characters that they knew. And they would all do things that came straight from, you know, that character's story. And, well, how are we doing that? Well, we're going to do that by putting cards in your hand. You're going to play the cards turn by turn. And, oh, yeah, the characters have to take turns, because that's something that happens in the mobile game, is it's a turn-based experience. And it's just kind of this snowball effect of, like I said, knowing where I want that ending to be, and then rolling backwards and seeing what's needed to make that end point happen.
That's so cool. And it's really interesting. So for those of you listening, Tag and I have played this game, so we have not very much experience, but we have some experience with this game, and we played it through once, and we'll talk about this later. We shot ourselves in the foot. That was our own fault. But it took us a little bit to pick it up. Again, that was our own fault. But it was really fun. And by the end of it, it was just all I wanted to play it again. And the thing that was just so cool was, again, just the gameplay and how it did it. This was probably one of the more advanced things, because I've never had where characters take turns, that I'm playing multiple characters. That was a first for me. So I really appreciate the design and how you did all this. But one of the things too is, we've got these different characters in this game. These different characters have different abilities. Spoiler alert, Ariel is
vicious.
She is vicious. Like, you wouldn't, you know, everyone's like, oh, I don't want the princess.
Producer Vern was like, she's got the weapon in her hand, because she has the trident in her hand. Yeah. And so he's like, she's coming out kicking butt.
Yeah, she was doing all sorts. She was dealing all sorts of damage. So that was like, came in from behind. None of us, right. I don't think, were expecting that. I think Vern took her.
Well,
like,
there's like Sully,
her, you know.
And what's the character
where you can
from
see,
Gargoyles?
Like, oh, what's
Damona?
Her name? Yeah, Damona. So
Damona,
you've got
like you think like they're tough, gonna be big, the kick butt, but there's little Ariel. She's
just going. Yeah. So that was so cool. So how do you design and flesh out what these characters are going to do, and how do you kind of keep a balance that makes it so that it's not like, well, you got Ariel, so you're gonna win, or, you know, like, how does that process work?
There's a little bit of a cheat available to me, in that all of these characters have been designed once already for the mobile game, so I can always go back to the mobile game. And I've actually I'm at my computer here. I've got a couple of screens, and one of the screens here is actually tuned into a fan page for the mobile game, where somebody has gone and cataloged every character, all of their attributes, all of their abilities, all of their skills, everything that they can do. So while I started this game by playing the mobile game and getting a feel for a bunch of different characters that I had unlocked, now I kind of take that cheat and I go the route of the fan page, where somebody's already done all that research for me, and I can look at a character and go, okay, so Sully's job is to be what's referred to in a lot of video games as the tank role. His job is to say, okay, guys, you're fighting me now. Come at me. Leave my buddies alone. I've got all your focus right now, and you can beat on me for a few turns, because I've got the body and the health to just take those punches and roll with it. And while you're doing that to me, Mickey's going to be over there throwing, you know, magic missiles and sending his mob of brooms after you. Or Maleficent is going to send Diablo, the crow, through a straight line of her rivals that she's lined up. And there's nothing you can do about it, because, again, Sully's over here saying, the fight's on me, guys. Deal with me first. So I was able to pick sort of archetypal characters that I knew worked well in a battle arena game. So we've got a couple of fighters. We've got a magic user in Mickey. We've got the tank in Sully. Ariel is actually a utility healer character. She does have some damage, but when you put Ariel on your team, her job is not usually to be out there on the front lines fighting. It's to kind of get around the sides and heal the characters that need healing. And then she's got utility cards that let her answer situations that might come up. Oh, your opponent's trying to do X, Y, and Z. Well, this card can nerf that strategy if that's the path they take. And Ariel's really good at that. Damona can fly around the board very quickly and deal a lot of damage, but she's also very reckless, which is something that comes from her personality in the original Gargoyles show. She just kind of didn't care. If she was out there just throwing damage around, she was there to throw damage around and not, you know, shoot first, ask questions later is sort of her way of playing the game. Aladdin, he's a thief. So his goal is to get out there and steal your opponent's options away from them. If you've played Aladdin, you know he can mess with your opponent's hand of cards. So he's not necessarily doing all of his damage on the board. He's doing some of his damage off the board as well. Dr. Facilier in the game, he's not an attacker. He's only got, you know, 1 point of damage when he attacks, whereas all the other characters can deal 2 points of damage. But what Facilier does is he's really good at just spreading out misery in the form of status effects that slow your opponent down and kind of hinders the progress that their characters can make. So by working from those archetypes and figuring out what characters from the mobile game fit those play styles, I was able to kind of flesh out the core eight characters and go, we've got somebody coming in from this angle and someone coming in from this angle and that angle. And these eight things all together balance each other out.
That's so cool.
I feel like that's difficult.
Well, I think you did a really nice job with it because, right, Vern and I lost. So, but it's still...
Only just, though.
Yeah, and that's the thing, only just. So it was exciting up until, like, literally the final turn. And yeah. I don't think that always happens with games because sometimes you kind of, like, you get... In some situations,
like halfway through,
you're like, well, okay, I'm just going to mess things up. I don't really have a chance, so I'm just going to, you know, whatever. I'm just going to have fun and enjoy it. But this, everyone was kind of on the edge of their seats until the end. And the thing that I really appreciated, we didn't know anything about any of these characters. We just kind of jumped in. Again, that pros and cons to just jumping in. But so we just picked characters randomly. I was Maleficent and Dr. Facilier. Vern was, he was Ariel. Who else did he have?
I don't know.
Gaston. He was Ariel and Gaston.
So you played a team game.
Yep, yeah, we played a team game.
Producer mm-hmm. James was Sully and Demona. Mm-hmm. And I was Aladdin and Sorcerer Mickey. And I think that was just, I was trying to pick people that had good health because I didn't want to die. But one thing we didn't talk about yet that I do want to mention, because I think it'll help people visualize this before we get too far into more stuff. I just want to describe kind of the game and some of the cool things about the actual physical game. So first of all, it's on a board. It looks kind of like a honeycomb. Each of the honeycomb kind of areas represents a space you can move to. There's some spaces in the middle that gives you some extra points. So you can read about it in the rule book if you want to play this. But there's a set. You basically get kind of the thing that looks like an hourglass that goes along one side of the board that each of the characters get, which represents the order in which you go through. It also is where, like, you know, power-ups or types of things that stunt you or whatever can all kind of be there. And there's some coins and stuff that go with that. There's cards that tell you about your character and give you your abilities and the certain things and how far you can move and what your health is and all of that good stuff. If you get defeated, how many points the other team or the other person gets for defeating you, that kind of thing. And then there's like your deck of cards, which has, you know, a bunch of different things with it. Yep. So it's a really cool game. One of the two of the things I really visually and just playstyle I love about this game is the characters are on like a almost like a plexiglass that stand up. They're gorgeous. Something you don't get in a lot of games is you have a front and a back to the characters. Mm-hmm. So if your person is facing away from you, you see behind them. It's unlike a lot of other games. It's just the front of them, both sides. Yep. And then the base that they clip into is themed to that character, but also has your health on it. And there's a cool ring that clips into the bottom that you rotate through as you get damage or get healed to tell you what the health is, which I thought was really cool. I hadn't seen something like that before.
And it stays in place. That is the big win there, is it stays in place.
There was another game we played called Betrayal on the House of the Hill, and there's a board that you get, and you get these little plastic things that clip on the side of the board that help you move up and down for your abilities. And those, some of them are very loose and they move around, and some are very tight and hard to move around. This was great. I thought it was so cool. I was really excited when we opened the box to put all of it together, because I was like, I don't know what this is yet, but this is pretty cool. I like how this kind of all works. And I liked the idea. There were times and turns, because there's a front and a back, I liked putting the characters facing each other like they were actually battling. Fighting. So really enjoyed that. But it's even if, like, I don't know. I just like looking at the game. I'm a very visual person. Yeah, it's a beautiful
visually,
game.
Yep, it's very visually appealing.
So,
and on that note, I was actually going to ask you, because you were talking about how you have a background in, you know, like art and mm-hmm. graphic design. Yep. So since this did come from a game that already existed, and you said that some of the artwork, you know, is from the game, the mm-hmm. mobile game, was there kind of something in this, the final product, that you were able to put your own artistic spin on, or what parts of this game are, you know, your view?
It's funny, because while I do have a background in art, I am not on the art team our game. But because I have a background in art, when I built the initial prototypes, one of those things that you get into as a game designer is that you have to test games. And to test a game, you have to build a physical prototype and put it in front of players. And I have found in my years of building prototypes to get them out there and get them played, there are a couple of hurdles that you're trying to get over and work through in your tests. One is, do these mechanics work? Two, another is, you know, are they presented in an intuitive and usable way? Piggybacking off of that, as a graphic designer, I've always looked at it and gone, if there's a challenge to learning this game, is it because the game mechanics are difficult and not well designed yet? Or is it because the materials that you're using, the card prototype itself, is not well designed visually? And as a graphic designer, I do take it upon myself to solve that visual information design as a part of the game design process. So if you ask, you know, what is there that I put into the visuals of this game, that may just be something as simple as the overall layout of, this is where on the cards the symbols need to go. This is how much space we should use for text. This other piece of information needs to go generally over here. And I could draw that roadmap and hand it off to the creative director and the art director and the graphic designer. And they could say with a high degree of confidence, these are good places to put these elements because the playtesters have been using the cards this way mm-hmm. and they find the information they need. We've proven that if you fan the cards out in your hand, the information that you can see at the top and the edge of the card are the kinds of information you need when you're deciding what card to play. And the graphic designer who worked on this with us, she was absolutely amazing at what she did. She created such fantastic templates and structures for things. She made suggestions as to, you know, moving bits of information around from here to there. So some of what you see in the cards came directly from our art team. Some of what you see in the cards came directly from the team that makes the actual mobile game. There's an artist, and I apologize, I can't remember her name right now. She and I have crossed paths on Twitter many, many times now. And whenever somebody compliments the art on the cards on Twitter, I always link back to her, because she was one of the original artists that designed the style for the mobile game. Mm-hmm. And since we've pulled so much inspiration from the mobile game, if there's credit to be given to the art team, it's our art team, our creative director, our graphic designers, the illustrator who's done all of the custom artwork for the cards. And I cannot leave the art team that made the original mobile game off that list, because so much of the visual that you get from this board game is inspired by the art that they created for their game.
I wanted to comment on that. One of the things that I loved about this game is I do like the visual style of the characters, because they're not, like, I'm looking at a picture on Board Game Geek right now that's of the Aladdin card. And Aladdin, of course, looks like Aladdin, but he doesn't look like the Aladdin from the animated movie. It's not that style. It's kind of more blockier, I guess I would say.
It's almost like a cell shaded style. If you've played a lot of video games in the last 20 years, cell shading was sort of a thing that happened in the early 2000s with a bunch of video games. And it comes and goes stylistically as trends do. But there's really sort of a flattened, cel-shaded look to the characters in the mobile game. And what it does is it makes it so that you can take characters from a lot of different sources. Sully is a Pixar character, and therefore he is, for all intents and purposes, a 3D model. Whereas Aladdin was designed in the age of classic 2D animation in a Disney studio, so he looks very different. And if you put Sully from Monsters, Inc., the Pixar film, next to Aladdin from the Aladdin Disney, you know, feature animation film, those two characters don't necessarily have the same stylistic elements. So when they made the mobile game, they gave this new stylized treatment to every character. And by having every character do that, they look a lot more cohesive when they're all in that same world together. So, for example, our first expansion, Turning the Tide, features three Oceanic-themed characters. Mm. We brought in Stitch, we brought in Moana, and we brought in Davy Jones from Pirates of the Caribbean. Well, Davy Jones is very much a live-action themed or styled character. But by having that art from the mobile game where they'd already done that work to make him look like the rest of the world he came, he was among with the, that new roster of characters, we were able to keep our standees and our card art looking very cohesive and consistent throughout our game as well.
That's so cool.
That's just nuts. The more we talk about this, the more my mind is just like, just blown by the entire process that leads up to,
you know,
us having a fun game night. You know,
it was about a year and a half of development time, of creative direction, of art direction, of, you know, production, component design and engineering, a year and a half before we were able to ship those files off to have them manufactured. And then, you know, three to five months later, you get those products in the warehouse that you can start shipping them out to stores and consumers and gamers. And it takes a long time to make a game like this.
That's just
so. I have a question for our times. This development of this game probably partially at least took place during the pandemic.
Yeah.
How did that affect the game?
Or did you know it? What? It almost was the silver lining of the pandemic. Working from home, I actually get a lot more done in a day without being called into spontaneous meetings here and there. I love the team I work with. And, you know, if we hadn't ever been forced into work from home mode, I would have gotten things done. You know, end of the day, the project would happen same as it did here and now. But one of the things that happened during the pandemic was we couldn't play test in the office anymore. And so we had to shift to a digital play testing system. And we had a guy on our on staff who figured out how we would go about doing that. He chose a system called Tabletopia. There are others out there, Board Game Arena and Tabletop Simulator are two of the big ones. But we went with Tabletopia for ease of building our prototypes in it. And then once we built our prototypes to function online, I was able to recruit playtesters from all over the U.S., including your friend Tom. Yep. You're all in Wisconsin. I'm here in San Diego. There's no way I could have ever invited Tom to come in and playtest with us in the office in Carlsbad, California. But because we could do all of this online, I could have playtesters in Ohio playing against players in Wisconsin, and we could schedule it anytime they had free time available for it. So we got in dozens more games in a week than we could ever have done having, you know, two open house nights a week at the office.
Oh, wow,
where we'd play, you know, one or two games. And the online testing allowed me to gather data from every evening's games played. They, you know, the players would come in, they'd play the game, they'd fill out a Google form that would fill a spreadsheet for me. And I could take that data and make updates to the digital prototype almost in real time, post those new updates, and then go into our message boards and say, okay, guys, this is what changed. Maleficent now has this card and this card, but we took away that other card. And this thing wasn't working with Gaston, so we changed the values on that card. Go for it.
Wow.
And they would jump right in and start playing again, and they'd have conversations in the message boards. And it's been a watershed experience that changed how we play tested to be, you know, in this world of you can't go anywhere. You can't meet with people in the real world. What are you going to do? And it meant that people were going online looking for experiences with other people who enjoyed board games. And it was kind of the perfect time for that to happen for us. I mean, not that I would ever have wished it to happen again.
Right, right.
You know, it's like necessity breeds creative answers. That was what happened. All of a sudden, we had to change how we did things. So we found the best possible solution to that issue. And it's been an absolute, I hate saying this, it sounds so punny, it's been a game changer for us.
Yeah.
So is this, so going forward, this is something you guys are going to continue to use?
Oh, absolutely.
That's awesome.
So pre-pandemic, what did playtesting look like? Was it, you had a physical?
We would have a physical prototype.
Oh, wow.
We would invite some people down to the office. We'd put out pizza and soda, and we'd say, here, we're going to hide behind this one-way glass and listen in on your conversations and see how you do with the rule book and teach yourselves and play a game and hopefully, cross fingers, have fun.
Yeah.
And then at the end, we would go in and interview them and see what they liked and what they didn't like. And of course, we're behind the glass, so if they're having trouble with the rule book, we're making notes about how to fix things and what to update.
The crazy thing, though, is then, okay, so then you've got your list, but now it's a physical game that they're playing, so you can't have them play test it again until you make new physical, you know, so the fact that
we're doing this digitally, I could have a conversation in real time with my playtesters, and as they're saying to me, you know what, I think this card needs to deal one more damage, or that character probably has too many hit points. Let's see what happens if we reduce that by one. I can open up my files on my desktop, make those edits, and in 5 minutes time have the prototype back up there so that they can play it. And I can, because they're playing it online digitally, I can actually watch them play the game as a spectator and listen to their conversation that they're having and be part of that test in real time.
That's cool.
Wow.
While there's four or five other games happening at the same time.
Yeah.
That's cool.
That's incredible.
So the question I think everybody wants to ask now, how do you become a playtester?
So in general, if you go to the op.games/playtest, or the op.games and then navigate to the bottom of the page, there's a set of links down there. You can click on that. You can join our playtesting community. It's largely done through a Discord server. So there's our message boards where you'll join the Discord server. You'll sign up to playtest various new games that we're working on. And we'll post sort of recruiting calls where you can sign up for different games. Right now, we've actually reached a place with Disney Sorcerer's Arena Epic Alliances where when we started, we had a very casual, wide set of playtesters. We had 25 to 30 playtesters at any given time who were just helping us develop this system that could be learned on your own pace. And is it fun? And do the core rules work? And we're all enjoying this? Good. Great. Let's wrap it up and do our balance testing and algorithms and numbers that show us if the characters have the right victory point values and all that good stuff. But now we're actually at a point where that pool of playtesters has condensed, and we've got a number of people who are incredibly adept and skilled at development and really picking things apart with a fine tooth comb. Mm-hmm. So we're sort of at a point with Disney Sorcerer's Arena Epic Alliances where if you were to jump into the playtesting group, you're jumping in to the deep end off the highest diving board we could find.
Right,
so it's actually a very intimidating point to jump into the playtesting process right now for this specific game. However, we always have new games that we're working on. And, you know, if you're interested in something that you see there and you sign up on the forum, we'll get back to you and say, hey, yeah, let's do a kickoff call and we'll introduce you to what this game is about and set you up on the digital prototype and show you how to access all the forms to fill out after you play your game. And we try to set it up so that players can find their opponents sort of on their own schedule. Hey, I'm going to be available on Thursday night and Saturday afternoon. Who's up for a game? Somebody else chimes in and says, hi, I can play on Saturday at 1 o'clock Eastern. And they go back and forth and you know, negotiate when they're going to play. And then as long as they've got the right tools to do that, they can schedule their own game. They don't need me there.
That's cool.
Fill out the form afterwards, send me the data. It dumps into a spreadsheet and I can grind that data whenever I need to get the job done.
That's awesome.
Wow. That's so cool. And the thing that I'm just thinking about is just how much more open this is. Because now you've got such a vast market because you've got, I mean, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter where you are. It's not, well, we have the same pool of people that we're having come in and look at these games. So you've got anyone, you know, anyone in the U.S. could do this because you just have to have a computer and an internet connection to be able to play test a game now. So I think that's so cool because you got so many different fresh eyes and just so many different ways to look at it. And I just, that's just really cool. Mm-hmm. I'm not just saying this because I know one of your playtesters, but I think, honestly think that everyone did a really nice job. Because like I said, when we, the first playthrough, granted, we jumped in and did the more difficult
version in the rule book, you could jump to a later thing. And James, who does a lot of games like this, is like, oh, I think that'll be too easy for us. We'll jump to the hard version. Spoiler alert for anybody who gets this game, just start at the beginning, which I did message.
You mentioned starting at the beginning. I don't think we've talked about the fact that the game is built so that there's four chapters in
yes,
the rule.
Yes, let's talk about
that. And you can start with, if you've never played a game like this before and you come to the game because you're a Disney fan and you've heard, there's this game where you can fight with all of these different Disney and Pixar characters and you're like, I've never done that before, but it sounds interesting. Where do I start? The game starts with training wheels. And it says you're only going to play these two characters versus these two characters at first. You don't even get to pick your teams.
See, we should.
Other than, do you want to be the red team or the blue team? And we walk you through how the cards work and what a turn looks like.
So you're not even playing
with all the components. You've just got the very basics, and we explain how the turn structure works and what your options are in that turn. And then when you've played that game a few times, you can move to chapter two, and we add a few new, more nuanced rules. We let you pick which characters you want to play with. You go to three characters on a team instead of two characters on a team. Then you go to chapter three. We add a whole new component to the game where each character gets an ability card that makes them very distinctly different from the other characters. They've got different health values. They've got a different number of cards that they put into your hand at the start of the game. They've even got a whole new phase to the game called skills, where every character has a very unique skill they can do each turn. And then once you've mastered that, you can add chapter four, which is an upgrade system where midway through the game, by spending cards that you've already played and that are in your discard pile, you can use those cards to pay for what we call upgrades. And it flips your character ability card over and gives you a whole extra ability for that character that just adds a lot more depth to how you plan your team, because not all team combinations lead to those upgrade chains efficiently. So when you're playing in chapter four, you're thinking sort of in two axes at once. You're thinking, how do my characters synergize just on their surface abilities? But then also, if I want to get maximum value out of those upgrades, where do they synergize in terms of feeding each other the resources they need to do that upgrade?
Yeah, James put us right into four. I'm listening to you go through the steps. I'm like, yes, we played with that mechanic. And then you said chapter two. And I said, okay, yes, we played with that mechanic. And then you got to the third. I'm like, well, maybe it was the third. And then you were like, oh, there was the skill where you could flip it over. I'm like, nope, we definitely played with that too.
Which, in James's defense, we did it. We got our way through. And it was still really fun. Nobody like tapped out halfway like, no, this is too much. But
in what hindsight, we maybe should have gone through it.
What I am going to do is I'm going to take four steps back since we started at four and start and do it again at one, because I think there's
I would recommend chapter two for you, because I think that once you've played chapter four and you go back to chapter one, the training wheels are going to be huge.
Sure.
And it's going to be hard to play the game and go, wait a minute, I'm not allowed to do that thing that I really enjoyed doing yet.
Yeah, sure.
That's a good point.
I would start with two, maybe even three.
Because I feel like after we were done and we were reflecting on it, we're like, oh, we probably could have this. Well, or we probably could have, and that was all stuff that we just didn't know we could do.
So. Towards the end, too, we found ourselves like asking questions because we were looking at something and something would dawn on us. And like, we would turn to James and we'd be like, because he's the rules guy. And I said, so when we're trying to upgrade, can we only use the cards for this person, or can we share or whatever? And he's like, let me check. And then he'd look and be like, oh, yeah, we can share. And then we were like, oh, well, that's not how we were playing.
So when you're playing the team game, you can share one card to your teammate to pay for an upgrade.
Oh.
Yeah.
If you're playing 1v1, one player versus one player in just a head-to-head match, you don't have a teammate to borrow cards from. So you're playing from your own discard pile to pay for those upgrades. And if you didn't build your team with that synergy in mind, you may find yourself. So for example, there is a magical team you can build with the core set where it's Mickey, Maleficent, and Dr. Facilier together. And these three have fantastic synergies for their magical abilities that feed off of each other. However, Mickey and Maleficent use the same, I refer to them as gear sets. The cards with the, when you look at the symbols that you use to pay for their upgrades, Mickey and Maleficent have the exact same assortment of symbols on their cards, which means you're coming up short on certain kinds of symbols because you've overinvested in that, that set. And when you try to upgrade any of your characters, you'll find that you probably only have the cards available to upgrade one instead of two or three of them.
Vern ran into that with Ariel and Gaston, that he would only have enough to upgrade one or the other because there wasn't enough. Yeah.
Yep.
Yes. So there's that sort of team construction consideration when you start. And a lot of the players who've put in, especially the current playtesters who think so analytically about the game, there's a lot of thought that goes into sort of cross-optimizing these two strategies. Am I willing to give up the upgrade on character X if it means that the synergy between characters Y and Z is that natural synergy that happens without the upgrades? How does this grease make that wheel turn better?
I do want to say, because I feel like at this point in the interview, people listening might think this sounds very complicated and it's too much for them. I think of people like my mom who, like, this just sounds like a lot. This is a family game.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody can pick this up. Don't
start at four.
Start with one. If you're a seasoned player in these type of games, maybe go to two. But start slow. Don't do like we did. Don't jump right in. And you'll find that, you know, and I found this with, we had talked before the interview too about that you had worked on a Harry Potter game as well, which we've also played and really love. Mm-hmm. As you play it more and more, you get used to how everything kind of works. And so you can add additional things and it becomes more advanced. It just kind of keeps it interesting instead of like, okay, here, you know, like Monopoly, right? It's like every time you're just going around the board and trying to, you know, whatever, that's Monopoly for you. Where these type of games, there's so much expansion and so many different ways. They've got upgrades. You've got all these different things you could do. You could synergize and get things. So it just keeps it interesting to be able to play it multiple times. Your first game, you're probably not even thinking about this stuff, but it's still very enjoyable. And Teresa said that earlier too. We didn't know any of that stuff. We kind of shot ourselves in the foot, and yet it was still fun.
It was still fun, though.
And we were still able to conclude the game.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We roll a play.
Yeah, and while the goal is to get the player comfortable with chapter four playing the full game, each of those four chapters is its own well-structured and balanced game. So if you find that you and your kids really enjoy playing chapter two, because that's what your kids are into, play chapter two as many times as you like. It's a game.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If you get together with your friends and they're just really competitive, spiky players that just want to explore every nook and cranny of the game that they can optimize to win, play chapter three or four. Like it's flexible enough to play with whatever your audience is at a structure that they enjoy.
I think that's really smart. I think that's especially because of the IP, right? It's Disney. So you've built this so that it can appease and can be fun for all ages. The other thing that I think was fun was, right, you've got different types of people that are playing games. Mm-hmm. You've got, like, in our group, you've got James, who's very rule driven and, like, can remember all the different things.
He likes strategy.
He remembers all, he can strategize like crazy.
I hate strategy.
Tag and I just enjoy the adventure that we're on. And then Vern's kind of somewhere in between the two, where super strategy, like strategy, but also enjoying. All of us, nobody was frustrated. We all had an enjoyable time. So I think that was the other really cool thing, because not all board games can do that, where it is enjoyable for someone that just likes the adventure and we'll see what happens, versus someone who's thinking like 10 steps ahead of themselves.
Well, like one thing that is, so this is a personal experience, so nothing against this particular game, just to put it out there. But James and I played, I really wanted to play Risk.
Sure.
And twice, James and I sat down to play Risk, and I apparently have the worst die rolling luck ever. And it wasn't fun, because Risk, people who've played Risk know that Risk can go on for hours. It's like Monopoly. It can go on for hours. And our game did not go on for hours. Our game went on like 45 minutes because my dice rolls were so bad that he just annihilated me. And it happened both times. This game and this play style, if you have something you're not good at, a dice roll or something like that, there's enough different mechanics going on at once that if you're bad at one thing, that doesn't sink you. It's like there's a lot to it. So everybody's got an equal
opportunity. There are no dice in this game.
Yes, well, that too.
Yes, yes.
You can't blame wins and losses in this game on bad die rolls.
Yep.
Right.
That's very true.
There's a shuffled deck, so the random number generator is still there in the shuffled deck. Random die rolls are one of those things that can really be a turnoff to heavy strategy gamers.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And we wanted this game to appeal to heavy strategy gamers at that chapter four level just as readily as it appeals to Disney fans who aren't gamers. So we left the dice out, and we made it so that the card play, even if you get a quote bad hand, say I've got three characters in my deck and all of my cards in my opening hand are for Sully and none are for Mickey or Maleficent, there are still other things you can do with those cards, those Sully cards. You can pitch them off of Sully's turn on Maleficent or Mickey's turn to boost their movement or to boost their basic attacks. And then when you finally draw into the cards for Mickey or Maleficent, you can use their cards to get the bigger Mickey and Maleficent functions out of those cards. So I worked very hard to make sure that we mitigated the random luck factors as much as possible and kind of put control of the game back in the hands of players as they played the game.
And I like that.
Well, and it felt like an even playing field, if you will. Like, it didn't feel like, well,
because James is such a strategy player, it didn't feel like he was just annihilating us.
I'm gonna go off onto the game nerd stuff here. In Magic the Gathering, you've got a deck of cards, and there's 60 cards there, and it's a random shuffle. And at the highest levels of gameplay, a lot of the players will tell you that you build your deck to be as consistent in what you want it to do as possible. But when you're starting and learning the game, the randomness of that shuffled deck is actually a great tool for bringing new players in and retaining them. And Richard Garfield, who designed Magic the Gathering, has a whole lecture that he'll give at events about the importance of randomness in board games. And it's when you've got a game that's high strategy, like, say, chess, and there's no randomness, the more skilled player will win the game every single time. There's virtually no chance that a low-skill entry point chess player will be a grandmaster, because the grandmaster's seen it all, knows it all, and there's no randomness. But if you introduce a little bit of randomness, now all of a sudden that novice player does have a chance. It might be the proverbial chance that a snowball has in a very hot place, but they still have a chance. And when they do win that game, they still feel like, okay, I was lucky, but I won the game and I want to play this again. Mm-hmm. And they don't feel like they're just destroyed by a higher skill level. So this game, by shuffling your deck in Disney Sorcerer's Arena Epic Alliances, there is the chance that a higher skilled player can get a proverbial bad draw, and that may slow them down enough that a new player coming in has a little bit more of an advantage or chance in that early game or in that end game or whatever point they're at. And that's good for retention. It's good for making people feel like they had a chance.
Uh-huh. The other thing that I think is so fun about this is I feel like it'll have good repeatability. Like, I don't feel like the game's going to play. There's no way the game is going to play out the same way every time you play it, because you can either, you know, it's right, like you said, that you've got the randomness of your deck, but then you also have all these different characters that you could
switch up your team.
Yep, switch up your team. You could even, so we played like 2v2, so it was Vern and I versus Tag and James. So you could even switch up your teammates, you know, if it's not the actual physical characters that you're switching up, because that's going to be a different play too. So I think that's what's so enticing and so exciting about this, is that it's not just kind of some games you've played it once and you're like, oh yeah, that was fun, but you don't feel that draw to necessarily dive in and do it again. Whereas this one, as soon as we were done, I was like, I wish we had time, because I would like to do that again. So
we did the math once, and in the core set you've got 8 characters, which means that if you take whatever team you want, that the blue player chooses their team, they've got 8 options for that first character they put on their team, 7 options for the second character, 6 options for the third character. So that's 8 times 7 times 6. I'm not going to try to do that math off my head. Once upon a time I could have. Now it's I need more coffee to do that.
I need more.
But then you've got your opponent who
336.
Then has 336 options for the first player. That's now the second player has fewer options, because there's only 5 characters left to pick from, and then 4, and then 3. But you can mitigate that by drafting your characters and picking, I pick, you pick, you pick, I pick, I pick, you pick. But you look at the number of combinations you have of one team versus another, and you multiply those against each other, and there are thousands of different matchups that you can play. And we assume it's different if you take team ABC in the first game we play, and then I take that same team ABC and play it against you in the second game. We've got more, you know, we've doubled our replayability there. When we're playtesting new characters for this game, I currently, in the prototype we're using, have 21 playable characters in that prototype. And we're planning more. And there are characters that were in that prototype that just weren't working that we took out of the prototype. So with 21 characters, when you're picking your teams, we're somewhere in the millions of combinations of possible matchups. You're not going to run out of playable content. I mean, that assumes you play a team and go, okay, I've played that team once, I never need to play that game, that team again.
Right.
And I'll pick a new team. But there are teams that players feel very comfortable with. They really enjoy the way this one team synergizes. And you know, for example, that magical characters team in the core set, I may not care about those upgrade chains. I may just really enjoy the synergies that that deck, that character team has all by itself. And I'll want to play that as many times as I can.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm with you, because a game that you've worked on is not Disney, but one that I feel I can speak to exactly what you're saying is the Harry Potter game.
Oh yeah,
I love playing Ron Weasley with the certain type of upgrade that they have, and because I like to kill things, and his thing is
the wrong player too.
He gets the lightning bolts that you can place on villains to kill them.
Also, lovingly known as zappies.
Zappies, we call them Vern. Vern coined the term zappies, and so I like playing that. And there's an ability that you can have where if you know depending on what your health is, you can keep the tokens or the money to buy stuff or whatever they. We call them coins. I know you had corrected us earlier about it. And you can keep zappies depending on what your health level is. And I like that. And then there's also an ability, depending on what pack you're playing and everything, that if you assign so many of them, then you get, like, health and other stuff. And so I am really comfortable with that. I know how he plays. I like knowing that. And I enjoy every time we play. James doesn't even give me an option. He sets Ron right in front of me. He knows that's what I'm going to do. And he'll go pick somebody else. So I assume that as we play this game more, I'm sure that I'll find a playstyle that I like and I feel successful at, that I will always want to be that person. Because I'm the type of person that if something goes really well for me and I really understand the character, that's what I want to play every time. Because I get frustrated because, like we went over, like, I'm not a strategy person. So if I can just, like, brute force through something, that's going to work well for me. If I don't die all the time, that works well for me. That kind of thing. That's what's fun for me.
You want to brute force your way through? You want Gaston, you want Demona, and maybe you want Sully or Aladdin in that third spot.
I really liked Aladdin.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And actually, I really like Sorcerer Mickey because I ended up getting the broom upgrade or whatever, and I had little tokens on it. And then I went over to poor Teresa with
it was
somebody. It was either Maleficent or something. And I went over and I was like, oh, I can do like 6 damage to you. Boom.
Yeah, yeah,
and that was a lot of fun.
Mickey's got the ability to just really do a ton of damage if he gets ignored for too long.
Sure.
You can't sleep.
They were ignoring me.
Mickey only gives up 4 victory points. You're only going to earn 4 victory points when you knock him out. So it's, you know, the equation there is that it might not be worth the effort to knock Mickey out because you're not getting many points back for him. But if you ignore Mickey for too long and he builds up those brooms, I've seen games where Mickey will hit somebody for 8 points. Mm-hmm. And on the very next turn that he gets, because they couldn't knock him out in time, he walks up to Gaston and just knocks him out for 10 points of damage in a single swing.
Yeah.
Wow.
And, like, you know, Mickey just wrecks house when you don't pay attention to him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, and kind of to build on that, that was the other thing I found enjoyable with playing through the game, was even though Mickey came up and just, like, went, poof, you're done, and I was, you know, whatever, killed, booted off the board. Yeah. Yep, knocked out. That's it.
KO'd,
that's right. I was knocked out. It wasn't like I was in timeout or anything. You know, it wasn't like I was out of the game. I just started away from everybody.
Over.
It's not like other games where it's like, well, that really messed everything up for me.
No, I will throw this out there. This is an overlooked rule. A lot of players, the first few times they play, they will miss the returning to the arena rule. Mm. Allows you to put your character on any of the star spaces.
Oh yeah, no, we covered. James covered that.
Board.
Okay, that came in handy
because he was like, you could sneak up behind people.
Yeah. Exactly. So if the core of that fight is migrating to your opponent's end of the board or to your end of the board, it's designed so that when you bring your character back into the arena, you bring them back as close as possible to where the action is. And that was actually. That was something that a playtester came up with.
See, good job, playtester.
Good job, playtester.
That was good. Well, because that actually worked to my advantage one of the times I had been knocked out. I came back into the game, and I came back on the opponent side. Mm-hmm. And it was Maleficent, and she could move too. And it then put me within range to do all sorts of damage to all the people that were there. And I just kind of, it's like, oh, you're going to knock me out?
When I watch some of our current playtesters play the game, I'll be sitting there watching a character hover at 2 health points.
Yeah.
And I'm like, why are they not knocking them out? And then it'll dawn on me, they're actually leaving the character there because based on the board position right now, if they knock that character out one turn too early, that character will be in range to move back up in from the other side of the board. Mm-hmm. To hit another character they're trying to keep alive, So you don't knock out Aladdin, because if you knock out Aladdin, he will be able to sneak in from behind on the other side and knock out Sully.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And it's all about the timing of when you take them down, because that respawn is just such a tricky strategy to work with.
Well, that was the first part of our interview with Fletch. We will continue it again next week, where we talk a little bit more about the game design and game industry.
It's okay. I'll be the only weekly tier without an answer. Make sure you send your questions to Producer James or Producer Vern at trivia@doweekly.net.
Welcome back to Trivia Land. You ready to find out how good you did?
Sure.
How well you did. Wow, that was terrible.
Other things.
I apologize for that grammar there. All right. So let's find out how well you did tonight.
Okay.
Your first regular round question submitted by listener Keith N. When the Jungle Cruise first opened, what was on display in front of the entrance? You guessed a jade elephant or a snake. The correct answer that I was looking for was a pond with baby alligators.
Oh. Very.
So if you remember back to previous questions, a long, long time ago, Jungle Cruise originally was supposed to have live animals.
Yes.
And they pointed out to Walt that he couldn't have live animals. They'd all be sleeping. So he said, all right, fine. Can I at least have a pond of baby alligators?
How long did that stay there? Do you have any idea?
Oh, if you'd asked me an hour ago, I had just read how many years they actually kept it up. But I don't remember now.
Okay.
Your second regular round question from listener Donna S. What two attractions in Fantasyland have a mermaid? You guessed Peter Pan and It's a Small World. The correct answer I was looking for was Peter Pan and It's a Small World.
Woo-hoo.
Nice. Well, we have done. To give the shout out to Elijah for helping us with that one.
Yes, you did use your phone a friend on that. Your third regular round question, submitted by me. What percentage of the way through The Many Adventures of Winnie the Pooh are you when you see the psychedelic Tigger? You guessed 70% and 50%. The correct answer that I was looking for was you are exactly at the 50% point.
Look at you!
And fun fact, he is the only psychedelic Tigger in any Disney park.
Wow. The one and only.
When you say psychedelic,
he's like fluorescent.
Oh.
It's like super fluorescent with the pinks and the purples and the greens. Bright. And all other Tiggers are just the regular orange, yellow, or orange, white, and black.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah. So and he's like standing on poo.
So in the Tigger song of the most wonderful thing about Tiggers is I'm the only one.
Yeah.
Specifically, that Tigger can really say he's the only one.
Yeah.
And your fourth and final regular round question from listener Jill M. How many different spellings for honey are there in Winnie the Pooh? You answered 4 and 3. The correct answer that I was looking for was 4.
Oh, yeah. Good job.
And your bonus question tonight. Can you spell honey in all of the spellings that are used in The Many Adventures of Winnie the Pooh?
Probably not.
You answered H-U-N-N-Y, H-O-N-E-Y, H-U-N-Y, H-U-N-I-E, H-U-N-E-Y. The correct answer that I was looking for was H-U-N-N-Y, H-O-N-E-Y, H-O-N-N-I-E, and H-U-N-N-E-Y.
Oh, we were so close.
Well, 50% on that one.
I gave you a half point.
Woo!
Yes.
I'm glad I said 4, because I was thinking of upping it to 7, but...
You were, yeah.
But I walked myself back off that ledge.
Yes. Good walk back on that.
Nice job. Yeah,
sometimes I do okay.
Well, listeners, how did you do listening at home? How do you feel about how Tag and Teresa did? Do you think you've got some great questions that can really stump them next week? If you've got that perfect question and you'd like to send it in, feel free to do so at trivia@dealweekly.net.
Well, we will be back next week with more Disneyland news and information.
Until then, go out and enjoy the parks.
Please remain seated until the podcast comes to a complete stop and the doors have opened. Then collect your belongings, watch your head, and step carefully from the episode. On behalf of all of our crew,
Thanks for traveling with us. And we hope you have a happy and memorable visit here at DL Weekly.